Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
In these troubling times, how can the arts and humanities soothe our anxious souls?
We asked some of our favorite Stanford colleagues to tell us what their fields have to offer in philosophy.
I think meditation really is doing something, and it helps you do future things, which are mental actions.
In music.
This might be a time to clear everything else you're doing for like 15 minutes, or 10 minutes, or 5 minutes, and just listen.
In literature.
Our job, it's a very hard job. We have to try to make good decisions and ethical decisions in this extreme darkness.
In drama.
How do you find an inner resolve to distance yourself from those experiences and set off on a new course? How do you find your song?
Join us for the second of two episodes exploring how insights from the arts and humanities can help us cope with difficult times.
Comforting Conversations, Part 2.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from our respective shelters in place via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, it's the second of two episodes featuring comforting conversations with some of our favorite Stanford colleagues. Asking them how the arts and humanities can provide comfort, connection, and common purpose in a world of social distancing.
Our first installment focused on stories and storytelling. Today, we'll talk about another novel, but also about music, theater, even meditation. Of course, this is not to say that comfort is the only thing the humanities can do.
Right. Moral philosophy tells us how to treat our neighbors and fellow citizens.
And political philosophy tells us we should be holding our elected officials responsible and demanding more from them.
Yeah, and shout out to discourse analysis for explaining why we should not use the language of war when we're talking about a pandemic.
But even when we're fighting the good fight...
Hey!
Excuse me. Even when we're doing the right thing, we might need something else to keep us going.
How about a little music, for example? That's Stanford professor of music and computer science, Ge Wang, playing his smartphone with an app he designed called Ocarina.
Ge works at the Center for Computer Research in Music and Acoustics, or CARMA for short, where he builds musical instruments, games, and social experiences. We asked him to tell us more about Ocarina.
So Ocarina is this app for a smartphone I designed back in 2008. You hold it like a sandwich and you play it by literally blowing into the microphone at the bottom of your phone. For example, and here I'm blown to the bottom of my iPhone while I'm using the on-screen buttons to control pitch in different combinations. And you can also physically tilt the device to control the amount of vibrato. For example, so there, that's me actually holding the phone flat and then gradually tilting it into a vertical position. And that changes the amount of vibrato that's applied to the sound, which is actually generated live in the app.
You know, one of the things I love about this, I mean, not just how wonderful it is to have this musical instrument, a sophisticated musical instrument at your fingertips, but also the fact that it can connect you to people around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about that aspect of its functionality?
Yes. So in the same app, you can actually listen to other people blown to their phones from around the world. And there's this globe visualization. Here's Anonymous coming from the United States West Coast. I'm not sure what they're playing. Possibly some free jazz on the ocarina.
Sci-fi music.
This is from Hawaii. And here's Indonesia, Peace and Love. Ha. Huh. And so this is a form of an anonymous social network, I suppose, based on music. And all you see is where they're coming from. You see kind of these beams of light emanate from the globe visualization that's visualizing the music. And that's kind of it. Now, you can choose to like something you hear, but that's a one-way street. I believe it was John Stuart Mill that once wrote that eloquence is heard, but poetry is overheard. So in a way, this is kind of a social musical world for overhearing, kind of almost like a music voyeurism, if you will.
So I love how kind of everyday this is, that like anybody could, as long as they had a smartphone, make this music. Do you see yourself as like making music sort of more accessible, just to like, is there a difference between being a musical person and being like a regular person or a regular people, musical people?
I think this was made really, Ocarina was made to be a toy and a playful thing, right? And I think the playfulness definitely lowers the bar of entry into noodling with this. And it's disarming. It's a joke, right? The gag here is that it actually works. There's a little synthesis engine and software that's running in this app that's generating the sound in response to how much you're blowing into the microphone. And also, of course, how you're expressing the pitches, how long you're holding the notes, and how much vibrato you apply. So it is something that, well, in a sense, is playful, is like a toy. But I think sneaking in there is the idea that it's also a kind of instrument. And I think of it as an instrument in the sense that this is something you could learn to get better at over time, something that you can learn to make your own.
Right. And I mean, you say it's a toy that just so happens to work. And to me, it works not just as a musical instrument, but also as something that brings us together, which is why it feels so relevant today. That it's something I can play in my living room, but it's not. I'm not just one person on my own. I can listen to that beautiful song coming to me from Indonesia, or the other tune coming to me from Hawaii. Is that the way? I mean, is that something that was in your mind when you were developing it, that it wouldn't just be a matter, I mean, it would, of course, be a vehicle for people to perfect their musical skills and maybe develop new songs and so on, but also it would be a tool for the overcoming of isolation.
It's interesting because the globe was designed both to feel like you're a small sense of connection, but it's also, like, in a way, it is there to acknowledge that a kind of loneliness at the same time, because in the globe you just see Earth, this visualization in this black background, and then there is this lone like stream of light particles that come out from the location on the globe where physically a person recently played and blew into their phone. And I think it's both a feeling of connection and an acknowledgement of loneliness. But I think to feel connected, we also have to maybe acknowledge that we are not always connected, in that even when we are connected, we might still feel, lonely. You know, I mean, to be honest, like, this whole app is kind of what you might call an unnecessary invention, right? I mean, literally nobody asked for this. No one said we need to blow into our phones and make music, and it solves no real problems that exist. But it's also kind of freeing in that way.
So I want to ask about separation and loneliness. So when I think about like some of my experiences with music, they involve like singing in a choir, which you kind of can't do right now safely. So how do you see like musicians coping with this? Like, what do you do about the kind of connection aspect of music when you can't be physically with people?
Well, that is it. It's a good question. I mean, I think there are some ways we can cope, and there's some things where we can only try to cope, right? I mean, I think having bodies physically in the room is not something you can quite replace. There's something visceral about, it's visceral. It's also communicative. Like, we pick up much more than just the direct, like, what is said or what is played, but there's like, perhaps 100-fold information in the way we, subtle gestures we make, the shared temperature of the room, the lighting, every small thing, I think, aggregates into how we actually sense others in a physical place, that even if we can kind of see someone's image over like Zoom or something, it's it's not quite the same. So honestly, I think musicians and really performance art and just artists in general, many of them are having a difficult time. It's truly a difficult time because we understand how important this embodied sense of presence actually can be, and we work with that. So it does present some issues.
I feel very lucky to be a poet right now, because it seems like poetry is sort of less time dependent, and you can sort of send letters and make them into a collaboration. And I sort of wish there were more equivalents for musicians.
Right. I think it really heavily depends on, I think, your medium or your mediums. And if your medium is one that's amenable to, if you're actually in your room painting, for example, that's something you could do largely the same, you know, painting wise than if you were an actor, right? If you had to go on the stage in front of an audience with people, I think those are seeing very different consequences under the current circumstances. But I think I feel like musicians and artists in a way are coping like everyone else. And maybe the difference, I don't know if it's a difference, but I think artists generally do try to always, pandemic or not, try to, you know, feel the pulse of the world. I think there's a saying in Chinese is that, you know, when the world laughs, you laugh with it. When the world cries, you cry with the world. And I think that's what artists tend to do, is they laugh and they cry with the world, and you gotta feel the pulse out there. And that's kind of that's the stuff that your music or your painting or your novel or your stories are, that's what they're made of.
Right. So I'm curious if you think there, like, what new art forms also might emerge from this smallness. So some things I've seen actually are musicians sort of coordinating using click tracks instead of in person. And also, like, it's fun for me because, like, I can still collaborate with musicians by writing lyrics and having them write a song to go with the lyrics, for instance. So I'm wondering, like, you find potential in, like, everything, like a salad bowl, you find music in that. So, like, what are some new musical objects that we might discover?
That's a great question. I think the really interesting things that will perhaps emerge from the situation are things that really make, like, fundamental use of the mediums of the time, right? And I don't know if we quite found necessarily those things yet, but the way that people are now, I don't know, broadcasting their DJ shows over Zoom or streaming, I think people have kind of upped their game. But also there's a kind of everydayness in the way that we connect. I mean, now we have, I don't know, musicians performing from their, like, bedrooms, because that's the only place they can do this, and broadcasting that. So in a way, it's, I don't know if there's any, like, I mean, I'm sure there are kind of forms, new forms of art that might emerge from this. I'm also really interested in just kind of how every day, how, like, the general lowering of expectations in a good way, of how we make art and who gets to make art, right? And I feel like that might be a kind of a silver lining to something that is tragic and horrible and that is affecting everyone.
That's a really lovely thought, but I want to say thank you so much for joining us on Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much, Josh and Ray, for having me.
Ge Wang, professor of music and computer science at Stanford, on music as a healer. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about how the arts and humanities can keep us creative and connected in troubling times.
Coming up, we'll hear from scholars in philosophy, theater, and literature about meditation and mental action, the politics of plague in 17th century Italy, and a play that brings people together.
More comforting conversations with our colleagues when Philosophy Talk continues.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're finding comfort and healing in conversations with Stanford colleagues in the arts and humanities. I'm Ray Briggs, here with my colleague Josh Landy.
We're joined now by Laura Whitman, professor of French and Italian at Stanford, and author of The Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, Modern Mourning and the Reinvention of the Mystical Body. Laura, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. It's very fun to be here.
So Laura, you wanted to talk to us about Alessandro Manzoni's novel, The Betrothed. Can you start by telling us a bit about why you chose this book in particular?
Well, I picked it because one of the central events in it is a plague that devastated the city of Milan in Lombardy in the 17th century. So the very same area where we had coronavirus recently. And this event was, for Manzoni, as when he wrote the novel, it was a 200-year-old event. And so he was thinking about, what does the plague mean 200 years later? So I thought that would be interesting for us to think about.
What do you think's the relevance to Manzoni writing in the 19th century of this plague from the 17th century?
He saw himself as writing the first historical novel for Italy as a nation, which didn't exist yet when he was writing in the 1820s, 1830s. So he was aspiring to an Italian nation, and he thought that a historical novel would be important to having a unified Italian culture. And looking back 200 years, I think allowed two things. It allowed him to say something about an essence of Italianness that was there throughout history. And it also allowed him to be critical of his contemporaries sort of sideways, while, you know, with the alibi, oh, no, I'm just talking about 200 years ago. But really, the way he describes the mishandling of the plague was also a critique of current authorities and a desire to overthrow them and turn Italy into a more modern, more democratic, we would call it, nation.
So no relevance to today whatsoever.
Oh, none at all. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm curious about choosing a plague as sort of your unifying image, just because, like, as you mentioned, a plague seems like very divisive and very easy for the authorities to mismanage.
So the plot of this quite long historical novel concerns these two young peasants who are in love, and they are betrothed, the betrothed of the title, and they really want to get married, and they can't because a local nobleman falls in love with Lucia, the female protagonist, and prevents her marriage to Renzo by intimidating the local priest. And so Renzo and Lucia run away, and they get separated. They have all these adventures, including they both encounter the plague and ultimately are reunited in the midst of the plague in Milan. So to some extent, the plague personifies these forces that are much greater than the individual, that the individual somehow has to navigate. And a lot of the story is just about how strong and how ethical these two poor plebeian characters are, in contrast with many, not all, but many of the representatives of authority throughout the novel. You know, they're very romantic era representatives of Italy, these kind of modest peasants who ultimately embody a lot more fortitude than many of the noble people around them. And the plague is something that they managed to navigate relatively well.
That novel does have a romantic feeling to it, not uncoincidentally, given when it's written, this feeling of us against society, right? Either the heroic individual against society, or in this case, a heroic, virtuous couple up against society. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, the legal systems are corrupt, and the power structures are corrupt, and the church, at least in some of its areas, is corrupt. But the heroic couple holds out. Does it strike you that this novel proceeds from a vision of the world in which there's just no point in trying to reform human institutions because they're just infinitely corruptible, and we should just kind of do what we can as individuals and couples? Or do you think there's a hope around the corner? Maybe we can make things better at the level of institutions.
You're getting to the core of something Manzoni himself was not entirely sure of. I think he wanted to have faith in institutional change, yet found himself writing a novel about these two characters who, you know, at the very end, the last paragraph actually concludes that crises or misfortunes can happen from causes independent of ourselves, the most innocent suffer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Trust in God softens them and renders them useful in preparing us for a better life. So that's the conclusion, is very individualistic. It's very much mm-hmm. about the individual moral fortitude in the face of suffering. I do think that as a whole, though, the novel does critique institutions that don't understand human behavior well. So I think that's where you can look at more of the details of the plague chapters and really see that Manzoni also wanted to be a kind of analyst of how crowds work and how power works. And I think a critic to the degree that critique can help create better institutions. I would say that he despaired of the historical novel as a genre being the way to change institutions. This was the last historical novel he wrote, as well as the first. And he wrote specifically that he felt that it didn't go into political reform and his changing the course of history from an institutional perspective.
So, Laura, I'm really struck by that last passage you read from the end of the novel. Just how it paints suffering as this great redemptive thing in the lives of these characters that enables them to be noble. And I'm wondering, does the book have like a coherent take on the value of suffering that comes from sort of natural disasters? Is it sort of a religiously significant thing that's given to you by God so that you can be noble? Is it just some random awfulness? What is the answer? Luis Manzoni has answered that question.
I think one important sort of moment that addresses this question of, you know, is there a hand of God here that is justifying all this, that makes this suffering meaningful, is the moment, of course, it's a very climactic moment when Renzo and Lucia, after hundreds and hundreds of pages of being separated, are finally reunited. And he finds her in the sick hospital, the Lazzaretto of Milan, that was set up in the midst of the plague to accommodate all the thousands and thousands of people who were sick. And he finds her, and instead of, you know, being completely overjoyed to see him, she's tearful and unhappy. And he finds out that during her adventures, she promised the Virgin Mary that if Renzo survived, she would give him up. She would not marry him. She would stay a virgin. So she made this vow. And this is terrible because now he's fine, but they can't get married. And the modest, humble priest who has been helping them also miraculously appears to be in the same spot. And he talks to Lucia and basically convinces her that her vow to the Virgin was a good, you know, a fair thing to do in a terrible moment, but doesn't really count because she had already made a prior vow to get married. And therefore, the Virgin can now absolve her of this vow that she made under duress. And it's very clear that Manzoni, and he intends us to get the irony, right? Innocent Lucia believes this story, but we, the readers, understand full well that this is not the hand of God. This is the hand of Fra Cristoforo, who is making the situation come out right because he can, because he's a figure of authority and he believes he's doing the right thing. So Manzoni's message overall, for the book as a whole, I think, is that we don't know what the hand of God is doing. It's completely unfathomable and mysterious, and we have to do our best. And people who are morally good, like Fra Cristoforo, who really helps people out throughout the novel, those are the people we should listen to. And they have to make decisions in the midst of terrible events. They have to improvise. They have to improvise the best they can in the midst of very difficult and incomprehensible events.
Right. I mean, if God is all powerful and all good, how does he let plagues happen on his watch? Maybe not just let them happen. Maybe he makes them happen. I mean, is it just because we're terrible people? But when have we not been terrible people at the end of the day? So it seems interesting to me that this novel, Manzoni's Betrothed, is grappling with that, and Camus' The Plague grapples with that, and Boccaccio's Decameron grapples with that. It seems like every novel about the plague or some plague or other feels like it has to get to grips with that central theological question: is there a God who is all good and all powerful? How do you think this novel helps us think about that question?
Well, I think the question is, you know, why? How does the novel depict this terrible evil? I mean, the first thing to say there is that it's Manzoni spends quite a bit of time helping us or making us see just how terrible it is, how much suffering there is, how so many of the best people are the ones to die, and children die. And we see this through the eyes of Renzo especially. So we're really meant to be emotionally affected and to feel very poignantly this question, how can, if there is a God, how can he let such things happen, right? I think that's definitely the experience you're meant to have. And I think that's why it's particularly remarkable that we don't really get a final answer. There's a sense that if there is a God, his proceedings are too unfathomable for us to get what they are. And here it matters that Manzoni was essentially a Jansenist. He really had this view that that God's judgment and his running of things is so far beyond humans as to be to seem arbitrary from our very limited perspective. And we have to operate, as it were, in the dark, really. Our job, it's a very hard job. It's a very Jansenist job. We have to try to make good decisions and ethical decisions in this extreme darkness. And I think that's kind of where he leaves us. And I think that's why he picks plague, ultimately. I mean, I want to say it's a very good question. Why have something so incomprehensible as part of your supposedly unifying national novel, right? And I think that here what unifies is the experience of being in the dark, which is, you know, it's a pretty bleak form of unity.
So I'm not particularly worried about justifying the existence of a Christian God, but I am worried about plague. What morals can I take?
Well, I think the thing that has struck me, this is a novel that Italians usually learn the beginning of this novel by heart when they're in high school. This is how well it succeeded in being the Italian national novel. So everyone is so familiar with this novel that it's really hard to say anything interesting about it. But reading it in the current situation, the thing that really struck me is that it doesn't just kind of push against an idea, a providential view of history where God, you know, everything happens for a reason. It also pushes back against a historicist view where we take actions in view of a certain direction that we think history should be taking. And it invites us to consider the present moment as the moment in which ethical action can take place, like the only moment that we have for ethical action. And that has really struck me as still true today, perhaps because things feel very uncertain just in the immediate right now. Of our situation, it's difficult to say, you know, what the bigger, you know, what goal for 5 years from now should I be striving towards? I mean, I can think of some, but I think it's very difficult. So he makes us think about how you still have room for ethical action, even in a smaller scale.
Well, it's a great note for us to stop on, Laura. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Laura Whitman on Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed, a great 19th century novel set during the plague in Milan.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're talking with Stanford colleagues from around the university about finding comfort and wisdom in the arts and humanities.
We're joined now by Harry Elam. He's Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at Stanford, professor in the Department of Theater and Performance Studies, and the author of many things, including The Past as Present in the Drama of August Wilson. Harry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Harry, you've got something to recommend our listeners to read while they're sitting at home, staying safe.
I do have something for folks to read, and it's a play. A play by the late, great August Wilson, an American playwright who did a series of plays, 10 plays on the African-American experience. This is his play of 1911, and it is Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
I already love that play, but when you, Harry, I'm sorry to make you blush, but when you produced this play on Stanford campus, it just blew me away. So I want to thank you for that. And tell us a little bit about the play, about August Wilson's Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
I'm happy to. And that production featured an actor, Sterling K. Brown, who's now won a couple of Emmys for the show This Is Us. He played the lead, Harold Loomis. And the play is about Harold Loomis's journey and what happens to him as he looks for his wife. He was held in servitude back in 1911, by Joe Turner, the brother of the governor of the state of Tennessee, Pete Turner. And he held Black men in servitude for a matter of years and then released them. And Harold, once being released, is looking for his wife, who he has been separated from. And he goes in search for 4 years of her with his daughter. So it's a metaphor for all that's left over in terms of slavery, the trauma of slavery, the isolation that happened in slavery, the dislocation from anything that happened in slavery. And the question for Wilson is, how do you make peace with all that? And how do you find an inner resolve within yourself to distance yourself from those experiences and set off on a new course? How do you, in the way Wilson puts it, find your song?
What is that? What do you think that could mean for us today, all sitting in our little splendid solitudes, one from the other?
I think it means, how do you find space to find space for yourself, to think outside of what the work you have to do or outside of all the other things you have to do around family? Where is that space to really, that you can sing and find that sense of self? And really, it's not in a sense that you're doing away with, your relationships with other people or your work, but it's finding that peace, that inner peace, you know, that you need to continue on. So for the end of the play, Harold Loomis walks out, it's an interesting scene that he walks out with this great new sense of self-determination into this. And one of his characters, Bynum says, "You're shining like new money," as he walks out. So how do we find that sense? How can we shine as we find ourselves?
So Harry, I think that that's a beautiful statement of an ideal, but I'm wondering what people do if they don't have sort of the space for splendid solitude or to find inner peace. So what if you're an essential worker who's just being run off your feet right now?
It's a really good question, right? And in terms of the play, another connection to the play is the play talks a lot about these bones people who were in the Middle Passage and that journey from African-Americans being Africans to becoming Afro-Americans or African-Americans in a new land and space. So there's a racial story there as well, and a story of being ripped from your place and not being able to award his time with Joe Turner. Similarly, he was in servitude. So, you know, clearly he wasn't or seemingly wasn't able to sing his song at that time. But the character Bynum says that still it's within you. You know, you've got it. All you've got to do is figure out how to get it out, how to sing it. And it's an interesting relationship between Harold and Bynum. I mean, and so that sense, there's a couple of moments that they have that's almost a call and response like you'd find in a Black church. So it's, you can't do it alone, but it's that sense of with some assistance, with some a sense of collaboration with what Bynum provides for him, potentially we all can find that sense of inner peace or that sense of self-determination. So it's not a place that blames other people, okay? It's not a play that, yes, racism existed. Yes, Black people were made slaves, but still, you know, even within that context, Wilson is saying you can find yourself. So even within, you know, the experience that some people are having, how do they find it? And you probably need it all the more to survive. I mean, I feel for those people, you know, who are caught in this and it's through no fault of their own. And a disease that's disproportionately hitting poor people, hitting Black and brown people. You know, how do you deal with that? And how do you find it? Can you still find your song within that environment?
Yeah, so you've kind of emphasized the role of like finding resources within yourself and of solidarity. So I guess another way to present this question is like, how do you make it sort of possible for other people to find their song, and how do you exhibit solidarity with them?
That's interesting, again, in the relationship between Bynum and Harold Loomis. Bynum is looking for, he saw this vision earlier, a very spiritual and religious vision. And in that vision, he was told that he needed to find the shining man. And if he did that, his purpose in life would be met. So the idea of finding help beyond you Reaching out to someone else is really important as well. Also, the play takes place at this boarding house where Seth and Martha are. And the boarding house is a transient place that people, a liminal space in a sense, where people come in and out of. But that sense of finding community there and finding a richness, even though you might have very little to make life of, is important as well. So the sense of community, the sense of this shared and reciprocal relationship that happens between Bynum and Harold is really important.
Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend. I'll help you carry on.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're leaning on the arts and humanities to find community in troubling times. We'll hear more from Harry Elam in just a moment.
We'll also think more about drama and theater as sources of connection and comfort, as well as the surprising philosophy of meditation when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. I'm Ray Briggs, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're thinking about how the arts and humanities can provide comfort, connection, and a sense of common purpose.
Let's return to our conversation with Harry Elam, author of The Past as Present in the Drama of August Wilson, on Joe Turner's Come and Gone, specifically on how non-Black audience members might respond to the play.
August Wilson was the most produced playwright in the last decade of the 20th century. So 1999, it's the same thing in the first decade of the 21st century. So if that's the case, a lot of people were going to see his plays that weren't Black, and finding within, you know, those stories and the human stories, characters that they could relate to, ideas, concepts. And I think that plays out in Joe Turner as well. The spiritual dynamic of the play is really interesting. It's a play famously that back in the honeymoon phase of his presidential experience, his first year as president, Barack Obama went up to New York on a date night with his wife to see Joe Turner's Come and Gone in a revival production of it. So that also brought an audience to the play. And interesting that that production, one of the more celebrated, was directed by a white director. So within the dynamics of his finding something that's particular about Black people in 1911 in Pittsburgh is something that he hopes has cross-cultural resonance to an audience that's broader than that.
So you've been talking beautifully about the play's theme of isolation and community, about how slavery isolated slaves one from the other, including in the context of this play, Harold Loomis from his wife. But it's interesting that the play isn't just about that. It seems as though it's kind of bringing people together. I mean, there's that lovely scene of the juba, the call and response dance within the play, where all these disparate people with different interests and ambitions and desires and fears all come together in this shared celebration. And I wonder if the play itself isn't kind of doing the same thing. Here we all are, audience members, even readers of the script, coming together, overcoming our isolation and joining forces.
Yes, I think that is the message. And I think that's why Harold needs to be understood not as a singular character. Yes, as Ray put it, he suffered this historic trauma, and the trauma of history is on his back. But it's something that in his final scene, in the climactic moment, he takes a knife and he cuts across his chest. His wife has been imploring him to come back to Christ, to Jesus. And he says, "I don't need anybody to bleed for me. I bleed for myself." And he walks out into the world after that. So it's a singular act, but it's an act with incredibly meaning beyond that, in the sense of community, that sense of, that your individual sense of finding yourself or bleeding for yourself in this case is not an individual act potentially, but it's something that is shared by the sense of community. Everyone in that community is searching, trying to find. And one of the spaces they find it is in the coming together. You talked about the Juba. It's a wonderful moment of celebration, of spiritual. So it's tying you with forces beyond, at the same time connecting you to each other. And that's part of the magic, I think, of the play.
And is it part of the magic of theater? Because obviously, you know, within the play, you see people coming together in this communal song. But here we are sitting all together in a theater, watching it and sharing an experience. Do you think that's something August Wilson may have in mind, that theater itself can produce that kind of communal spirit?
Yeah, he felt that it, not only could it produce that kind of communal spirit, but it's something that people could take with them out of the play. So that sense that theater could be a means to get people to think, potentially even to act differently, that he really believed in the power of the medium to do that. Quick side note of a story. There was one production of Joe Turner, and there were, it happened to be a big audience of Black women evangelists who were there. And when Harold Loomis and Bynum went into this call and response scene, about 10, 12 women en masse went up to the front of the stage and started praying with Harold Loomis. So that sense of the audience really feeling part of the action took on a whole nother level.
Well, Harry, thanks a million for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. Thanks for your great questions.
They tell me Joe Turner been here and gone.
Harry Elam on the August Wilson play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're thinking about how the arts and humanities can keep us thoughtful and cheerful in anxious times.
We're joined now by Antonia Peacock, professor of philosophy at Stanford. She's also a featured contributor at the Philosophy Talk blog. Antonia, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back.
So Antonia, I'm really frustrated with all this sheltering in place. I want to do something, and I don't know what to do from my own home. What do you suggest I should do?
Yeah, I think we're all having feelings of similar kinds right now. Something that I've invested more time in recently is meditation.
Wait, is meditation doing something? I thought it was just sort of sitting there and doing nothing.
So I think meditation really is doing something. And I think it's not only doing something, but it helps you do future things, which are mental actions.
Tell me what a mental action is.
Yeah, so I think a mental action is something that you do in thought. So some examples might be, you could try to recall what you had for breakfast. You could keep your attention focused on the hummingbird outside your window. You could rehearse your next day's lecture in thought. These are all mental actions as I conceive of them. And you can do them on purpose. You can do them well or badly. You can do them successfully.
So it seems like for at least some kinds of mental actions, I just can't do them on purpose. Like I can't have an invasive thought or abolish one on purpose. I can't want something on purpose. But it does seem like I can do some things on purpose. Like, what is the difference between the things I can do on purpose and the things I can't?
Yeah, great. So philosophers actually disagree significantly about this. I think the most famous skeptic about mental action is Galen Strawson, who in this 2003 paper said, look, you can't ever deliver a content to mind on purpose. You can only ever sort of set your mind to some task and wait for stuff to happen. So this is interesting for two reasons. First of all, it's a really clear and bold claim that a lot of people disagree with. But on the other hand, even our most famous skeptic about mental action thinks there's something that you can do, which is set your attention to a task. And that's what meditation is all about.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that seems already to concede a fair amount of the point to the other side, right? I mean, you can, in fact, affect what happens in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a pretty big concession.
So how does meditation work? Your claim is I'm setting my mind to a task, the task of meditating. And this is then somehow makes me better at performing other mental actions later on.
Yeah, so I think that the kind of meditation that works as an attention workout is not primarily setting your mind to the task of meditating as such, but instead choosing some object and attending to that. So One object that people often use is the breath. So you're supposed to attend to your breathing. And since this is an ongoing event and it's always there as long as you're alive, it's a pretty useful object of your attention to practice attending to.
So I'm wondering if like lots of things that I think of as regular actions that are under my control also have a component like this. So I can make pancakes. I did it this morning. But I have to rely on the world to cooperate with me to make pancakes. Like the stove can't suddenly go off. Then I'm not making pancakes. So like I contribute a lot of things and like the eggs can't suddenly be bad. And I don't have total control over this. But I still think that like I'm able to make pancakes on purpose. So that makes me wonder where the line is between something I can cause on purpose as long as the world cooperates with me, even though I didn't do every part of it on purpose, versus something that I can't cause on purpose, but I can cause by doing something else.
Totally. Well, Ray, I think your examples from earlier are helpful in this regard, because we want to think about whether your role in some event, when that involves monitoring how things are going and adjusting in response to errors, like you see this egg is bad, so you pick up a different one, or when you flipped this pancake, it fell on the floor, so you pour more batter into the pan, right? Whether that kind of monitoring and adjustment is contributing positively to the outcome that you really want to bring about, or whether it can detract from it. So if the case of happiness is like this, that if you monitored and you tried to control and you were constantly on task for trying to make yourself happy, that would be sort of deleterious to the end rather than helpful, then you might think becoming happy is not an action. But look, my pancake thing, there my monitoring was really contributing positively to bringing about the good pancake-based end.
So I can I know how to teach somebody to make pancakes because I can point to things outside of myself. So I'm like, here's the pan, here are the eggs, here's the mixing bowl. And I can sort of guide them through the actions, which involve things that we can both see. With meditation, like if you're trying to teach somebody to meditate, you're trying to teach them to direct their attention. And you can't see their attention and they can't see your attention. So how is it possible to teach somebody to perform a mental action rather than an action on like a shared physical object?
I think this is both a tricky philosophical question and a tricky question that faces us in actual practice, right? Something we have to figure out how to do if we're going to guide people through meditation. So one thing to note here is that the very notion of attention might not be something that you could teach somebody who didn't already have this understanding, right? William James is often cited as one of the early psychologists who wrote a lot about meditation. And even what he said here was, everyone knows what attention is, right? He didn't try to define it in other terms. He just said, you know what I mean. And here's a surprising fact. It does seem like people know what you mean when you talk about attention. So you might think that there's already something that everybody does and has ways of doing. And what meditation is a focusing down of that task. Here's how I think about guides to meditation. Your attention can be self-directed. Sometimes psychologists call this endogenous attention, or it can be grabbed by something outside of you. This is called exogenous attention. And one thing that meditation teachers can do is they can exogenously direct your attention, say, hey, wait a second, are you still focusing on your breath? That can, in fact, bring your attention back to your breath. So you get a sense of what it feels like to have that effect come about, to have your attention redirected. And then you can take the guide wheels off gradually and start to do that endogenously or start to do it yourself.
So I'm wondering if at a time when we're all sort of physically isolated from each other, it becomes more important to focus on mental action and if mental action can sort of get us goods that are maybe harder to get through physical action right now.
Yeah, that was my thought. I think one nice thing about meditation is that it's best to do it by yourself and that it has these results that help you out in isolation. So not only distraction is a big problem when you're working from home, but there's also something Proust talked about, the anesthetic effect of familiarity. So you might think, look, when I'm just sitting in the same room for days on end, the world outside of my body starts to fade into my attentional background, right? I'm just not even paying attention. And that can be really boring and stifling. Proust actually thought it was really comforting, but set that aside. I actually think that another nice effect of meditation is that it helps you think, what else is there to attend to here? And then you can do that on purpose better. So you start noticing things in your otherwise boring rooms and apartment that you might not have otherwise.
So suddenly the dirty dishes in the sink are really apparent to me. This is the benefit of meditation. That's what you're saying?
Yep, Jamie? That's the whole advertisement. Do the dishes.
I should have cleaned up after I made pancakes. Oh my goodness. Antonia, it was really wonderful getting to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Philosophy Talk.
Thanks so much for having me. It's almost like an in-person conversation. Pancakes for one.
Antonia Peacock on the surprising philosophy of meditation. You can hear the unedited version of our conversation with Antonia and all of our conversations from today at our website, philosophytalk.org.
We hope these conversations have been at least a little comforting, a sort of tonic for the troops.
Hey, I thought you said this wasn't a war.
All right. We hope these conversations have kept your spirits up.
Much better metaphor. That reminds me, isn't it time for a drink? Gotta be 6 o'clock somewhere.
Bottoms up.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2020.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Lauren Schechter.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program did not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.